you show the thing on the screen. This is like, okay, this is Chekhov's jade dildo. It really is, because they use it.
So, hello everybody in the wild internet world of Capricorn. We'll introducing ourselves here in just a minute. We're waiting on one other of our other panelists who I assume has been trapped in an elevator, but we'll get out when Parker shows up to help them. So, it'll be fine. So, welcome to the Skiffing Fandy Show's Screen Scouts. As Brandon will normally do in the thing, he will read us his lovely tagline.
Let's go steal a convention panel.
Which is, of course, telling you that we're discussing Leverage Redemption 2. I'm Sean.
I'm Brandon.
And as I said before, we're live today, and we'll introduce Mitchie as soon as Mitchie gets here, but our third will be Mitchie Trota, a Filipino writer, Friar Spinner, multi-award winning editor, currently editing the features editor at Prism, and generally a really awesome person, and we'll welcome them as soon as they're able to get there.
So, today, as Sean has so eloquently stated before, we are here to discuss Leverage Redemption, which you can watch right now, the entirety of Season 1, on IMDb TV. We're specifically discussing the second half of the season, which came out later last year, because it came out in two parts. But if you haven't seen the show yet, even though you are here and cannot watch IMDb TV while also watching this stream, we will let you know that this is a wonderful time to go online and watch it whenever you are able, because it is actually quite awesome. But since you're live with us, and leaving us would make us very, very sad, sadder than Elliot was at the end of the season, we would like you to stick around with us while we talk about our experience watching the latter half of the season.
Exactly. And so for folks that are live, please throw out your comments on the Discord and let us know if you have questions and stuff. Feel free to freeform it. If something's really grabbing you, go ahead and throw it out there. If you end up listening to this later, you can obviously send us your thoughts at skiffingfandy.com/listener suggestions. But we do want to hear what people think about Leverage Redemption, or even some thoughts about Leverage as an entire media property, which is part of what we're going to talk about today. So I think, Brandon, this would be the good time for us to get started on talking about Leverage Redemption now that we've seen the entire season. Oh, there's Mitchie. There's Mitchie. Mitchie's here.
Ta-da!
Mitchie's finally here. Sorry. Welcome, Mitchie, to the show. It's okay. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Look, literally an entire character was missing for the entire season of this show. So I think we can give you a little break. So
Does that make me Hardison? Because I am okay with that.
Yeah, you're Hardison.
It does.
Yeah. So
no one's debating the epicness of the entrance.
No. So to get us started, I thought we'd have some thoughts and reactions to the completion of this season, because we originally have talked about the first 8 episodes, and now obviously we have another chunk of 8 that we could talk about in specifics, but I thought we'd start with general thoughts. And so Brandon and I have talked already a bunch of setting this all up. Mitchie, what are some of your thoughts about the conclusion of this magic season of Leverage Redemption?
You know, I obviously hope we get a second season. But if we hadn't, I feel like that was a good way to end it. And I feel like it's absolutely, like, it leaves the door open, obviously, for doing more. I don't know if I necessarily need to have Noah Wiley's character come back. I really, really liked him, but I like how it's sort of set up where they can bring in a new person. And if we're talking, we're going on with a theme of redemption, it can be someone with a similar skill set, but not the exact same. Because I didn't know how they were going to accomplish moving somebody in to fill up the space that was left by Nate without making it like a complete redo and sort of kind of, you know, stepping on Parker's toes and stepping on Sophie's toes. But I think they did really, really well. And what I really loved about the season was getting to see Sophie doing her thing and seeing why she was so goddamn good it to begin with that, when she wasn't having to keep Nate from falling off a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we're like, oh, this is that ruthless part of Sophie that Nate clearly knew, but she didn't have to be that way because Nate was already being the ruthless one. And now it's like, oh no, this is why Chaos was terrified of having to deal with Sophie Devereaux in the original series. Like, this is Sophie unleashed, and I am here for more of it.
I thought that was great that you brought up the way that this series ends, because naturally, we haven't gotten to huge spoilers, so maybe a little bit later we might get in some spoilers, but when we get to season two, which I assume we're getting at this point, you know, they'd have to come up with lots of narrative reasons for certain characters to return, because they leave of their own accord. They have their own reasons mm-hmm. for why they kind of conclude this season. And so I thought it was great that you raised of, like, I don't necessarily need more leverage redemption. You're not unhappy about it. Because the way that this series ends here kind of feels like it is kind of an appropriate conclusion to the season. It doesn't feel like it necessarily has to continue. That's not a bad thing if it does. It just means that we get different narrative possibilities. And one of the things that I love about this is that the meaning of that term redemption, which we've talked a little bit about with some of the other episodes, but part of that is not just redemption for our typical cast of characters, but potentially also opening the space for almost like a therapeutic type of redemption for people they may interact with in the process of doing what they do to help people. And obviously Noah Wyle's character of Harry Wilson is a great example in this, because that's why he joins the crew in the first place, is because he feels like he's doing all this bad stuff and it's like sucking his soul out, and he wants to do something finally good, just, you know, through questionably illegal means. But, you know, such is life.
But, I mean, they also don't let Harry off the hook. I really like how they establish that very, very early on. Like, very first episode, you have Hardison laying down the law, saying that it's no, redemption is not a singular moment. It is a continual process. And this is something that, you know, Elliot knows and that Hardison has learned, and that they all, you know, that they all realize is that it's not just you flip a switch and make up for one mistake and suddenly you're a good person.
Right.
It's a theme that I've noticed through some of the shows that have really resonated with me over the last couple of years, like for The Good Place, also the way that Lucifer ended the show, just the idea that becoming a good person is a process. Becoming a good person is not something you can ever do alone. And while you are not going to get, your sins are never washed away, you can, there should always be some pathway or process, not just to redemption, but to reparation. So it is, I think this, what the show is doing is very, I think it's very smart and also very responsible in that it's filling our need to believe that people who have made bad decisions, and have done hurtful things can still become different people, but it's doing it in a way that doesn't minimize or erase the harm that they caused. And it doesn't mean that you get to ignore the harm that you've done. You can't fix it. You can't erase it. But you can be better, and you can find a way to repair the damage that you have caused moving forward. So I really, really like that. As opposed to sort of, you know, the narratives that we typically see where it's, oh, the bad guy, Skeletor suddenly feels the spirit of Christmas, right? Like,
oh, Lord.
Yes, which at some point we absolutely should do a discussion about the He-Man and She-Ra Christmas special, because, oh, my God. But yeah, that it's that sort of, it's not the simplistic form of redemption that we typically see in comics, and honestly comics and a lot of other spec fic, especially when they use the excuse of, but we're directing it at children. It's like, no, children are much more capable of complex thought than you think. And you're not actually helping them by making them think that it's this easy.
I like that easiness thing that you talk about of like, oh, well, the person's struggling with the things they've done, but they do one good act and all of a sudden everyone like just forgets that they did really horrible things, which I find a little frustrating. I mean, it's less so when the scale of the harm's lower, but you know, sometimes they'll do that for people who've like basically murdered like hundreds or thousands or millions of people. And they'll just go, oh, well, they did one good deed, so everything's fine now. And it's like, no, the scale of the harm is really matters here of how much forgiveness is even possible or redemption is possible with a single good act. And obviously, they think leveraged redemption deals with this in a lot of very interesting ways, because the kinds of scales of harm vary considerably, even in this season, even in just the 8 episodes we talked about, from very individual harms to, you know, entire communities being harmed. There's an oil spill episode, for example, which deals with that very widespread harm. And Brandon, you haven't talked in a minute, so I want to shut up and see, how are you kind of approaching this, or maybe bouncing off some of what Mitchie said, or even offering another take you want to take us to?
No, because one of the things that I did want to say, because I care a lot about the fact that the show calls itself Leveraged Redemption, and I've mentioned that in our last episode. And as a result, the thing that I adored the most about the end of this episode is, even though, spoilers, Harry decides he doesn't want to be with the team anymore, he's still willing to admit, I know my work isn't done, so I'm going to continue doing that work as a lawyer. Which I think is, like, really inspiring on its own, because I feel like that's not just Harry acknowledging that this is still a process, but acknowledging that there was a skill that he had before he met this crew that he has continually learned. One of the most interesting things about this last season in particular, he keeps learning that being a lawyer is actually very valuable. He was just a very evil lawyer. He just needs to be a good one. And him learning that is still a valuable tool that he has, and that he can use it by itself, is really inspiring about the end of that season, because it's him deciding, I don't need to continue working with this crew, although I value the work that I did, because at the end of the day, there are people who need lawyers. And that's a job that I can still provide. And I really appreciated that was the decision that he made. That he's not just going to do anything in the world, but that he decided that he's going to work pro bono for people who need it.
Fun fact about that made me think about, it was very personal, and I'm glad that they recognized that what he was doing was going to come with a financial cost, because the kind of work he's talking about is not get rich lawyer work. Right. It's the kind of work you do where you're getting paid in cords of wood, which is the thing my grandfather did, because he was a pastor first and then became a lawyer. And apparently those two things, if you're an honest pastor, don't mix, because he would take on all this pro bono work. And like my entire life at my grandma's house, the same like 3 or 4 cords of wood he had taken as payment were still there. The fireplace never worked, so they never used it. So there was all this wood piled in the back of the house, and he would do that all the time. And so I appreciate that recognition that this is work that is grueling.
The fact that Harry says verbatim, I am going to be very poor, and doesn't seem bothered by that.
No, he's not. And, and obviously, he's probably not actually going to be poor, because let's be real, the leverage team's going to probably finance him. He's just not going to be filthy rich.
He's going to find 5 figures in his back account every couple of months.
Well, I mean, where do you think he's going to, like, of course, this works out for the leverage team, because their work isn't necessarily done after they do their jobs. I mean, this way they can refer clients to Harry, and but we can't afford a lawyer. Oh no, we've already taken care of that. It's fine. So
that's a really good point, right? They can just say, like, your legal fees are taken care of. Harry doesn't have to, like, eat, you know, like, top ramen, but he also
top ramen is not that bad, as long as you can, like,
let me rephrase, off-brand ramen noodles, like 25 cents a pack, where that's all you're eating.
Once you know how to prepare those ramen noodles, they will actually be much better than you initially imagined.
Always,
but
always keep frozen vegetables in your freezer. You can throw them in your leftover chicken or whatever. It's totally fine. But before we get distracted, Brandon, I love that you pointed that out about the lawyer thing, because I didn't make that connection with why the golf job was actually much more pivotal than I had originally. I mean, I enjoy that. I enjoy that episode. Loved the hell out of it. But I hadn't made that connection with the young lawyer character in that, and said, you know, and her just saying like, no, being a lawyer is really valuable, and having and just making the connection that that must have been turning in Harry's head as he was going through all of this, and how that influenced his decision in the end. Like, that's great. Yeah. That's a really great point.
So I have a lot of feelings about the golf job.
What feelings do you have, Brandon?
First of all, hey, that's Spike. But that's like just a thing that happened in my brain. It's leverage. Of course, they're gonna get like actors that we know from a thing, doing a thing that I thought that was really cool. But also, Sarah, the other lawyer character, the actress of which totally escapes me at the moment. I really liked her story. For the same reason that, like, for a reason that I mentioned when we did our breakdown of the first half of the series, which is, I wanted to see more secondary characters get opportunities to, learn that the things that they are doing are wrong, even though Sarah doesn't necessarily need redemption, because she's actually a very good person who just doesn't know that she's working for a very evil law firm. And has very strong convictions about the work that she's doing, but is willing to sidestep some of those convictions in order to work in this firm in the first place. And Harry giving her the opportunity to know, to realize that the work that you are doing is valuable for all of the reasons that you say they are, but you're working in a space where the rules are continually changing, and sometimes you will need to figure out what you need to do in order to come to terms with that, was really interesting, because Harry's not talking to someone who is evil like he was. He's talking to someone who is naive like he would have been in the beginning before he became evil.
Yeah, because didn't he say he, like in the first half of the season, he had originally, when he joined the firm, they were going to change the world in a good way. So, I mean, there's very much the, that Sarah is Harry from when he started as a lawyer, thinking that he was going to do good things and that they were going to help people. And just the idea of how that gradual turn can happen to anybody, because the world is complicated. It is, you know, you are faced with a increasing number of choices that are, you know, that often narrow into bad or worse. So it's I like how it doesn't pass judgment. I wish that we'd seen more of that gray area, a sort of like applied to some of the characters in the earlier half of the season, particularly the former congressman. Who was, I'm still gonna feel ways about that episode, as like a big missed opportunity.
Me too.
One of the things I think that's interesting about all this is that, you know, throughout this show, you know, not just the redemption, but even before, there's this constant recognition that even people who are otherwise good people can get sucked into the sphere of this, sometimes for reasons where their agency's been taken from them, as in the case of the golf job, where this young fellow from a Vietnamese family is sucked into basically a bunch of con jobs, you know, at a golf course where a guy's trying to steal a bunch of money under the threat, right, that his mother will be deported and he'll never see her again. But you see this throughout the entire show that, you know, even with this young lawyer that we learn about, or even other characters that are being shown, that sometimes people that are good can get sucked in. Even Harry's wife gets kind of in the sphere in a really interesting way. And it really raises, and there was a comment or a question, which kind of was back when we were talking about redemption, which is about, you know, does one have to sacrifice everything to achieve redemption? And I think my view on that would be that leverage redemption in particular says that not everything needs to necessarily be sacrificed, but that in order for you to get there, you have to start to recognize where you are in the sort of the schema of the world to start making those appropriate adjustments. So this young lawyer meeting Harry's actually a good thing for her because it might make her more aware of the kind of people she's working for and the kind of work she should be doing to better meet her ethical foundations. But it's also beneficial for Harry because he now is meeting this person who was more naive like he might have been at one point. But he's now seeing that, okay, well, but maybe I can help her see another path and maybe I can find a new one for myself as well that would allow me to do the work to actually undo some of the harm I've done and then undo the harm other people have done. I think part of this question is like really a question of like completeness. I think the series is suggesting that it's not. But maybe that's also kind of a good thing, because if we could all just have a perfect world tied up with a bow, right, there wouldn't need to be any of the process of continuous revision, which, while this show's about the issue of redemption, that's a particular kind of revision, but that's like the human process. Like, we should try to leave the world better than we came into it as best as we're able as individual people. Not all of us have Parker to go through, you know, air vents and things to come help us, but, you know...
Yeah, I like that idea of sacrifice, actually, because I think when we talk about what should we sacrifice for redemption, a lot of the time we tend to think about that in terms of what are the material sacrifices we have to make, right? Like, Harry is going to sacrifice, you know, the very considerably large salary that he was making as an evil lawyer. You know, he'll be sacrificing material comforts and... But there are also other sacrifices that he's making that I think are even more important. Like, he's sacrificing a huge portion of his social support. He's cutting himself off from his coworkers for, you know, yeah, evil law firm. But those were, he still probably had, it looked like he had a genuine connection to his boss and was very heartbroken to realize that his boss was not open to having that reconceptualization of the kind of work that they were doing and why. And I think the biggest sacrifice for Harry was actually not material. It was sacrificing the dream of reconciliation with his family, with both his wife and his daughter. Because I think that was, you know, it was implied pretty heavily that he hadn't admitted to himself until, like, pretty much the second to last episode that what he really wanted deep down was to become a good person, because then maybe he could regain the two people who he loved the most and lost because of his actions. His relationship with his daughter looks like it's going to be great. But in order for him to move forward, he had to sacrifice the image that he had kept in his head of his wife, of who she was, and had to let that go in order to see the reality of who she was now. And that she was not the person, either she was never the person who he remembered. He had idolized her, or she had just become somebody different in the time that he had gone. But she was not that perfect moral person that he had built up in his head. And I think those are, for a lot of the, even the main characters in Leverage, I think some of their biggest sacrifices have been these conceptions of themselves. And the ideas of who they thought they wanted to be and what they thought they wanted in order to actually not just only find redemption, but be able to create good with their actions.
The thing that I find so interesting about Harry's ex-wife as a character in particular is I read that situation differently, and I feel like the fact that I did was purposeful, because in that moment when they speak last and she tells Harry that her current husband was actually taking care of her and that's why she's not going to leave him, even though they just learned that he's responsible for covering up an oil spill. I immediately saw that and went, oh, your problem with Harry wasn't that what he was doing was evil. It was that he was prioritizing it more than his relationship with you. And it doesn't matter to you what someone does so long as they care about their family first and foremost. And I'm like, I get why somebody would do that. It's still kind of icky, but it's not in and of itself evil. And I would have loved for him to have gotten an opportunity to wrestle with that as well. And unfortunately, there was no room for that and his own personal observation about the fact that he feels guilty about the things that he's done. But I would have loved for him to like come to terms with the fact that she is not making this decision because she's evil. She's making this decision because this is the family that she wants. And now he's realizing that's not the kind of family that he wants because he wants to prioritize becoming a better person. But instead, they just kind of frame it as, well, I guess he just sides with evil now. It's just kind of weird, especially considering that now I understand what her personal motivation is. And I felt like there was room to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I agree. I love how they're really kind of refusing to draw very easy moral lines particularly Harry's growth.
Yeah, and one of the things I thought that part of that too is when we get to, well, the Muddy Waters job in particular, and then obviously the Harry Wilson job, that issue of the sort of complicated moral grayness, even is like on that oil rig before it's blown up, because the people working there presumably have some knowledge of what's going on. But when they're destroyed in this horrible fire by this evil company of Riz, you know, there's a clear recognition that these are still people with families and so on. I mean, there's this hilarious moment when Elliot is pretending to work on there and they call in to say that they pretend that he's having a baby. So they hold a baby shower for him. And so he has this immense amount of respect for these guys that are working, you know, on an oil rig. You know, working for a company that just happens to also be doing some really shady, gross stuff. But there, that moral grayness of like, you know, good people can get trapped in these worlds where bad things are happening, and it's not as simple to just say they're just all bad people.
Yeah, it's like, oh, they should have known better. It's like knowing better is not knowing better is a privilege. Being able to choose. Being able to choose according to your ethics is a privilege because of the way that this world is structured, because of the way that capitalism forces us into positions where we have to choose between our morals and our the ability to survive. That is definitely one of those things where it's like, I wish they leaned into that just a little bit harder, but it's, if you're looking for it, if you're already thinking about those things, I think that it's pretty clear that the show is also a critique of the limited choices that people who aren't occupying positions of wealth and power and privilege have, and that compounds the damage. Someone like Harry absolutely has the ability to choose to do differently. Because he has capital, he has wealth, he has not, he has that background and wealth of knowledge. But you know, folks like you know the people working on that oil rig, they don't. You know, it's pretty clear that they don't have those. Same number of options as Harry.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I thought that come out of that would be the contrast with the great train job. Which is, you know, basically a variation of the sort of like white supremacist militia / Proud Boys kind of thing, which is a bunch of people who clearly can make different decisions but have chosen to remain within this framework in which they're basically committing hate crimes in this and engaging in apparently having sexy mustaches. I don't really understand why that's part of the culture, but sure.
It wasn't a good mustache, though.
No, it was a creepy mustache.
I think part of that, though, is like we're a little extra biased by the fact that they're all like evil monster people. So
maybe it's bias, but a part of me was like, you ever see a mustache and you know someone's evil? Like, I saw that mustache and I immediately thought, like,
it is like
Daniel Day-Lewis and Gangs of New York, this is gonna give me a bad feeling. And then it immediately gave me a bad feeling. So maybe I'm biased.
I mean, a bit. But it's okay.
I do want to speak very quickly to two things. One, the very comic aside to me personally of where did all of that baby shower stuff come from on this oil rig is a thing that absolutely delighted me. Like, where did the cake come from? Did somebody bake a cake in a half an hour? But also, I want to speak very briefly to something that Mitchie pointed out, because it was a thing that, like, I cared so much about, I literally physically took note of it. Which is, the show has taken, especially in this half of the season, has spent a good amount of time pointing out secondary characters who are aware of the fact that they definitely objectively want to do good, but know that the reason why they can't is because they are not as important as the people who have power and privilege. And in the unwellness job is like the starkest example of that.
Oh, Melanie!
I liked Melanie a lot. She was very smart and very principled, and like literally, like a thing that I noted idly rewatching the episode is that she just carries around with her folders of dozens of scientific papers about like things that will actually make people feel better. In her bag, it's the same bag that she's carrying every scene. She always has that information on her. She's always eager to want to educate people and try to do what is genuinely good and genuinely noble. And here is Bronwyn Locke, who is undeniably Gwyneth Paltrow in a way that I absolutely adored. I'm just going to sell people snake oil because I just care about people liking me and valuing the decisions that I have made for them. And there's a point when Brianna, who is on the grift at that point in time and is not like talking to Melanie like out of character, Melanie turns to her and says, "It doesn't matter what you know if no one will ever listen to you." And I felt that because at that point I knew she's here because she's hoping that Bronwyn will be the kind of person who will do the right thing. And that's why she always has that information with her. So at some point they could do the right thing. But no one's listening to her.
Yeah.
And then she gets the opportunity to actually talk to people who will listen to her. And that is the thing that that truly improves people's lives afterwards. Not just that they've conned Bronwyn and now her enterprise has shut down, but that Melanie gets the opportunity to reach out to people who actually want to do that kind of work. Is essentially the job that they did. The job was never Bronwyn. The job was actually putting Melanie in a position where people can actually value her expertise. And I think the same way about the Great Train job as well.
Oh, and notice how both of those characters are women of color who are like, who understand that they want to do the right thing, but they don't have the resources. So they are making what they feel is the only choice to tag on to some sketchy, questionable, rich white people who are the ones who are drawing all the attention and who are getting the financial backing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really like, I love how it's not, you know, it's something where it's just obvious that this is the way that it is. You don't need to call special attention to it because it's right there. It is right in your face. And I don't, like, before we went out for the unwellness job, we just have to like take a quick second because Chad Deal, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Everything about that episode I love a lot. From the fact that it's Sophie's opportunity to be peak Sophie.
Oh,
and everybody
gosh.
Just like allows her to just run the con because they know exactly what's motivating her in this moment. The fact that Sophie makes like the observation to everybody that it feels so weird to be in a con where someone is selling nothing and being paid in nothing.
Yes! It felt like a very, like, oh my god, I'm so old. Like, look at all these, look at all the Gen Zers on the TikTok. I don't understand any of this. And it felt very, but it also felt very true to Sophie finding something that makes her feel like, am I too old to do this game? Am I too out of it to be this now? And it was also a really lovely callback to the original Leverage episode where the Mark was someone who reminded Nate of himself. And it just made Nate super angry. Like, Nate, and the way that Nate would, the way that Sophie was indicating her, like, oh, this person's way too much like me and I don't like this. Just her tossing, just saying, like, she tasks me and I shall have her. And throws the knife at the watermelon. And everybody's like, what's up with the knives today?
I also appreciate the episode for having, they at the very beginning they have a very good conversation about, you know, what is a Leverage International type of case, you know.
Yes!
And obviously it's Brianna that brings out, you know, exactly what's being done, which is manipulating algorithms in order to influence people's decisions by figuring out how to manipulate Google, basically.
That was so disturbing to have them put it up there like that.
Especially yeah. Because while it's exaggerated in terms of, because they have to some degree, it's real, right? These kinds of things are influences happening all over the place. I know that we made the Gwyneth Paltrow reference, but it's all of the people in that group, you know, it's all these people that are selling basically snake oil, spelling nonsense. This episode does the thing that Leverage does really well, which is just takes it to its most extreme form. There's literally a moment when she's literally making up that they're just going to give people bee toxin as a way to, yeah, like, as a health thing.
Let's just sting people with bees. Maybe it will help.
And I'm
people.
Sitting here going, wait. Like, because the way that it's being framed is clearly, like, don't listen to what doctors might tell you, you know, even if you have a bee allergy. It's like, no, do my thing because you'll be healthier if you do this. But I'm just imagining all these people who, you know, aren't thinking about these things because they're not medical experts, who are allergic to bees or don't know they're allergic but are taking bee toxin and killing themselves. But the way that this yeah. frames it as, well, look, you it's not real medicine, so this is kind of you took quote unquote homeopathic medicine, so it's all your fault to yourself. I mean, that's kind of how I see this going, and it's horrifying. But also this what Leverage does really well, which is takes these serious issues that are happening and kind of amalgamates them into, you know, singular figures to explore, but isn't also subtle about, like, what the actual moral or ethical conclusion of that is in a lot of cases. In this case, right, she's a charlatan. We should not listen to a darn thing she tells us is good for our health. And yet that's part of our culture to some degree, at least in the U.S., of the charlatan medical. I mean, it's the goop thing, right? It's just like, you know, go steam your feet. That's not what she told you to steam, but I'm, you know.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. God. Can I just tell you the giant jade thing? We all know what it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just, okay. I died. First off, that they had it, and I'm like, okay, this, you show the thing on the screen. This is like, okay, this is Chekhov's jade dildo. It really is. Because they use it. They actually use it at the end. Like, Elliot uses it to knock out the big security dude. It is hilarious. And he's just like, what is this? And just like, Melanie's like, yeah, we're not going to talk about it.
You don't want to know.
I feel dumb. What is it?
It's a giant jade dildo. That's what it was.
Yeah.
I did not know that that's what that actually was. Okay.
Oh yeah. That was taking the joke about the jade egg things that women, you know, that, if you have a vagina, you're supposed to, it just took that joke and went with it to the inevitable extreme. I was not expecting them to go all out.
That's horrifying.
That, but I died. I just started, rolling on the couch and laughing. I had to explain to my husband why I was like, why the joke was so funny. Yeah, he had the same look at Sean's face. He was horrified.
It's like, the very first time that I saw that episode, and like, they cut away from Melanie describing it, and then cut back, and the very next thing that she says is, for 1 hour.
1 hour!
No.
It's just the look. So, I keep forgetting the actress's name, but the actress who plays Brianna, her comedic timing, and particularly her skills at physical comedy, are so good.
At least Shannon is good. Brilliant. I have a lot of Brianna feelings that I will state later in this episode. Trust me, I have a lot of Brianna feelings.
Well, we are coming down to, like, it's 1:43, so...
But Sean was about to say a thing.
Well, I was going to say, because when I started watching this season fairly recently, I've watched like way too much television the last like week. So including all eight of these episodes since Tuesday. So one of the things that immediately got me was the bucket job, which we haven't really talked about, which is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I will say this is an episode that immediately set the tone for these eight, because not only did they do very clear homages back to Reading Rainbow, because it is LeVar Burton who plays Mr. Blanche in this episode, and he's a librarian, and he is like a superhero librarian who helps people find the perfect book. But there's also ER references later because of Noah Wiley, cracked me up when I was sitting and watching with a friend, and I was like, that's the ER music, isn't it? And it's in fact the ER music that's in it. But the bucket job is... I was just like belly laughing, because it is both really adorable but utterly hilarious. To the moment that the script turns when they realize that Mr. Blanche is not just this sweet little librarian, he's in fact got skills that don't make sense. And the moment that got me was when they'd set up to have this Ferrari that they're gonna drive away in as a getaway car, and Mr. Blanche goes, no, they'll know what to look for, and he basically hotwires, butts out a window and hotwires this random car, and they're just driving.
And just the look on Elliot's face, he's like, what the hell is happening?
And they're just go with it. And I was laughing so hard.
In hindsight, I totally get why Elliot constructed that con the way that he did, under the assumption that he was not, like, working, that they would not meet an actual spy. But hindsight, Elliot should have been like, oh God, this guy's an actual spy. Like, that should have been the thing that pointed it out to him.
Oh, I think he started cluing in, but he's like, nah, we can't possibly. Like, is he? Yeah. No.
It's interesting.
A librarian can't be a spy.
It took him a moment to, like, make the actual direct connection, but Elliot's definitely sitting here going, he has some skills that a librarian typically would not have. And, of course, Mr. Blanche's answer to things is basically, I read a lot of books.
Yeah.
I feel like this whole episode was sort of Dean Devlin saying, I'm so sorry for not getting LeVar Burton in an episode of The Librarians.
It's the most wholesome episode, I think, this entire season for me.
Yes.
It is beautiful in every way. I love the bucket job. It's my favorite episode. The second I saw it, I went, I don't know if anything else can top this, because it was just... It's chef's kiss.
The Star Trek, like actually having to go to a planetarium for clues.
Mm-hmm.
And I am impressed that LeVar Burton kept a straight face through all of this. I wonder how many takes it actually it's like, oh my God. Just the whole like, oh, can we what, like, hey, you wanna hang out and watch some TNG? And he's like, what's TNG? Just dead. Absolutely dead. Just
it's great. They've done a really good job when they have guest stars who clearly are famous for like other big media properties of making sure to like do cute references, because I think Leverage is one of those shows that, yes, it's dealing with social issues in very unique and fun and exciting ways, but it is also a show that's very aware that its central premise is a little silly. And so they just have fun and want to throw these things out there to kind of remind people that we're playing in this sandbox of a thing that doesn't really exist in the real world, which is probably my favorite thing about Leverage. Because unlike a lot of other shows which deal with very heady, serious topics, there isn't this sense at the end of those shows that the world we get when it's concluded is actually necessarily better. It's very gritty, you know, the world's super messy. Mm-hmm. And I get that that's the real world. But in Leverage, like, there's this constant sense of, like, a hopefulness of, like, yes, the world is still kind of messed up after they solve a case, but it's still better. There's still this long sense of like the next thing that comes along, we're going to handle it. It's going to be resolved. And Leverage does this beautifully because it's playful. It has fun with its reference. I mean, God, Noah Wiley must have – he must also have had issues keeping a straight face when he's basically pretending to be a doctor.
Oh, God, the ER scene. Yeah. Like, the ER scene. Oh, my God. I just
– it's hilarious.
I will admit, I hadn't actually grown up with ER. I've never actually watched an episode of ER. But I've seen trailers and know that Noah Wiley is in it. And I was like, oh, that's what's happening here.
And the answer he has to it
is he in ER with this kind of intensity that he's playing in this
yes.
scene? Because now I kind of want to watch ER.
Even,
yes,
even
he
more.
Is.
There's even more intensity because of what happens to his character in ER. But again, the fun part they do is because it's a different universe, he can't acknowledge that he is Noah Wiley. So then they say, like, how'd you know all of that stuff? Because he's just...
Yeah, TV.
He's like, I just watch a lot of TV. Like, it's just like... It's a perfect answer. It's like, yeah, when we're acknowledging we're making the reference and we're not going to pretend that that's not what we're doing, but we're going to have fun with how we deal with it for the characters. So.
Yeah. Can I be like the fun, one of the most fun things for me was the rivalry with a considerable degree of mutual respect between the RIZ between the RIZ woman and Sophie, because they're both, you know, just they're wearing black and white suits, like sitting opposite each other in that table at the very, very end. I was just like, it's such a great reference to the, white knight, black, black hat sort of thing that Nate had going on. And just the fact, they have this in any other series, I feel like it would be corny. But when they're walking down the hallway together and the RIZ woman's like, oh, I just have to ask, this con job in 2004, was that you? And, Sophie's like, yeah, that was me. She's like, respect, I just as another woman in a male dominated field, I just have to give you some respect for that. And it was just that banter that we get between the two of them. Not only really great homages to the original with the thing that Nate would do with the marks, just having it be there where Sophie is just totally in control of everything. She is comfortable. This is who she is. And she's come back to this on her own terms. It's such great character development.
Well, so we're getting kind of close to the end point, and obviously there's bits in our script we have to do at the end, but I thought it'd be fun, since I kind of started this anyway, maybe to see what your favorite episode of this batch is. And I've already said it's Bucket Job for me, and I will say about Bucket Job for everybody, if you've never seen Leverage, you could watch Bucket Job pretty well on its own. It'll make sense, which I think is great. But like, do either of you have a particular favorite that just really is like... inside your brain? It's an evil question, and I don't care.
Yeah, this is an evil question
because I kind of have a three-way tie for like competing nerdy reasons. Well, two are for competing nerdy reasons, and one is just like very personally fulfilling to me. So I'll just very briefly mention them all, because they kind of. So I really like the Jackal Job. I really love the Golf Job, and I really love the Great Train Job, because they all do a series, because they all do two things that I dig a lot very much in their own ways. So first, one of the things that I wanted to mention, because I need to geek out about Brianna, is I love very much that this half of the season is as queer as it is. I like that the Great Train Job actually has two canon queer relationships in it, and that one of them is Brianna just meeting a girl on a con and going, she's cute.
Was so cute,
and that was really rad, and getting to see them be nerds, and getting to see Sophie trust Brianna with a grift, not because she trusts Brianna's capacity to lie, but because she trusts Brianna's capacity to be perfectly honest. And it just tells her, lean into your emotions as much as possible. Which is another reason that I love the Jackal Job, because she puts Brianna in charge of talking to the Jackal, precisely because she has experience with a relative with Alzheimer's. And, like, I admire the fact that they gave Brianna as much opportunities to do cool stuff in this half of the season. Not necessarily because they trusted that she had gained new skills, although she was genuinely gaining those new skills, but because they trusted the person that she was before she joined the team, which is really cool for me. And I want to see more of that play out as possible. But the other thing, the other personal geeky thing in my brain that I like a lot is that the golf job mentions a thing that I didn't think that anyone would mention, which is the fact that there's a South Korean Leverage adaptation that actually exists. And everyone that Hurley mentioned by name as members of the South Korean team are characters in that series. Their hitter, Roy, actually does have a pit bull named Elliot. I thought that was really funny that they mentioned that that was real. But also, the thing that I dig about the golf job a lot is that Hurley has shown at that point that he's been with this team for so long that he knows them very well, to the point where he could just stop and mention things about Elliot that he was not immediately privy to, and make, like, come to conclusions about who Elliot is as a person based on that information. I thought that was really brilliant, and I kind of want to see Hurley again, because Hurley is really cool.
I need to see Peggy. We need to see Peggy come back, too.
Yes. Peggy would be cool. Tara would be cool. I kind of, on the one hand, I would like to see Brianna get an opportunity to work with Tara on a job as at some point. But also, I want to see if this happens in season two, I would love to see an episode where Brianna has to handle a case all on her own.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
because everybody else has gotten that opportunity to prove themselves in that way except for her. And I think that would be really cool to give her an opportunity to just take her initiative on a con entirely by herself. And I hope that happens in season two.
I will list really quickly the ones that I loved, but I want, and then, because I wanted to say so, like, some things that I hope we see in season two. So the unwellness job, the great train job, and I keep forgetting the name of the title of the very last episode. But those were my three favorites for the season. What I'm really hoping we get to see next season is, one, can we stop crushing Elliot's heart, please? Can we just give Elliot someone to make him happy? Because yes, he is going to, you know, till his dying day, Hardison and Parker are, you know, those are his forever partners. But man, you know, I was really pulling for him and the Marshal.
Yeah, that was really cool. And she was willing to, like, she was willing to accept everything up until that point when she was like, oh, you're a criminal. A part of me actually wants this relationship to work regardless of that, but I'm a U.S. Marshal, I can't. I kind of wanted to come back. I wanted to realize that she was wrong.
I just want Elliot to be happy. Yes. I want to see Peggy and Tara come back. I would actually like to see them sort of, like, circle back around to some of the characters from the original season who, like those who they intimated that they were going to be doing more with other folks. And if we do not get a Leverage International, like a true set of international episodes in season two, I'm going to be deeply annoyed. There's a Nigerian team. There is a Korean team. I want to see all the teams.
Yeah. Because they said they have at least 12. They mentioned that they have at least 12. I need to meet one of the others.
I think it would be really cool. Yeah, I would love to see that in season two for them to actually have some of the characters from these other Leverage teams show up. You know, ideally including the South Korean team, because that one actually has been filmed and is a real thing that exists. But it would be super cool to have some of that international stuff presented here. Like, what would it be? What's one of the other teams? Like, is there a Nigerian Leverage team?
Yep, there was a Nigerian. There was a Nigerian team. Mm-hmm.
They mentioned the Nigerian
team.
They mentioned the London team. They mentioned the South Korean team. I want any Caribbean team, please.
That would be cool.
Doesn't need to be Trinidad. I would love to see a Caribbean team, please.
Well, I think we're going to start our process of closing out. So thanks, everybody who joined us today live. And if you're watching after the fact, thank you to you as well. But before we head out, Mitchie, who is our guest, our magic guest who spins fire for fun, is here to tell us about where to find your stuff. So thank you so much for being on here. And please, where can folks find you?
Okay, you can find me. My day job is as features reporter for the BIPOC-led news group PRISM. So you can find us at prismreports.org and at prismreports on Twitter, Insta, Facebook. For the fire spinning, I perform with a group called Rax Geek. So you can find us at raxgeek.com, RAKSGEEK. It's also at RaxGeek for Twitter, Insta, and Facebook. And then for me, you can find me at Geek Melange. That's MELANGE on Twitter and Instagram. Keep an eye out. I am going to be starting a newsletter this month.
Perfect. Well, this is great. So thanks, everybody. If you'd like to let us know what you thought about the episode and you didn't get a chance on the Discord, you can, again, go to skiffingfanti.com/listener suggestions and throw it out there. And if you're listening at home, obviously you can do the same thing. If you want to find this show, we're available at many places. You can get us on Twitter at skiffingfanti and Instagram at the same place. You can get our newsletter at skiffingfanti.com/newsletter. And we're obviously at skiffingfanti.com, and we're on like iTunes and Spotify and all those magic places. If you like us, you can go to patreon.com/skiffingfanti and let us, you know, support us there, or you can throw reviews someplace, preferably nice ones, because I mean, it's just, life's too short. Don't be mean. Let's just be nice. As for me, I'm at Sean Duke on Twitter, SeanDuke.net, and patreon.com/thejoyfactory.
And you can find me at The Rising Tides on Twitter, and on Speculate, where I currently GM Fractal Spire, a Girl by Moonlight actual play.
Perfect. Well, I now need to make it awkward so that we can conclude this properly. And so I will let everybody know that the three of us will be starting our own leverage team. Mostly, though, we are going to be getting people with fire spinning. Brandon will be confusing people with beautiful poetry. And I am just going to wear weird hats and run around and make people uncomfortable. And that's how we're going to solve all of our crimes. So
cool. I mean, poetry is technically grifting, so we have one of those skills.
There you go.
Down pat.
Grifter, so, yeah. Mitchie is our, I guess, our muscle. And
yeah.
I'm also the cook.
And the cook. And I guess I'm just the guy in the golf job, what's his name, that likes tacos.
Hurley.
I'm just Hurley. That's me.
Hurley was very useful.
It's true.
So,
but
yeah.
But he does have a taco problem. So, anyway, we're done. Awkward ending and scene. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And
thank you.
Thank you so very much.
And done. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanti or skiffyandfanti.com, our website, where you can get access to all of our fancy things. Our music comes from Holy Mole. You can support him and his work at patreon.com/holymole. Thank you for listening.